I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, a brief reprieve from the coronavirus talk we've been having lately. I know some of my listeners are probably happy to hear that. Instead, on this edition of the program, we shift our attention to the subject of presidential history. Specifically, the relationship between presidents and Black America, with Margaret Kimberly of Black Agenda Report and author of the new book, Presidential, Black America and the Presidents. Often, when the figures who have served thus far in the White House have passed into the realm of history, we can view their presidencies with rose-colored glasses. Margaret Kimberly, however, takes a critical look at all of the U.S. presidents from founding fathers like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson to the New Deal's Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And even, yes, believe it or not, the great emancipator, Abraham Lincoln. Even more recent presidents, such as Bill Clinton, and, believe it or not, the first Black president, Barack Obama, do not escape Margaret's critical scrutiny in her ambitious examination of the relationship between America's presidents and Black America. And with that being said, I hope you'll enjoy my conversation with Margaret Kimberly. So why don't we get right to it? Welcome to Parallax Views. Margaret Kimberly, author of Presidential, Black America and the Presidents. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for inviting me.
So, Margaret, we're going to be talking about Presidential, Black America and the Presidents. But before we do that, I wanted to ask you about Black Agenda Report. It's one of my favorite news websites, and I may have a few listeners that are new to politics or just becoming more interested in these matters, especially young people, since the sort of Bernie moment happened, I think they're going to be really interested in Black Agenda Report. Maybe you could tell my listeners about it.
Sure. Black Agenda Report was founded in 2006. I was one of the founders, along with Glenn Ford and the late Bruce Dixon. And we had started off at another site called Black Commentator, and for a variety of reasons decided to do our own thing. And our tagline is analysis from a Black left perspective. And we do reporting, commentary, a book forum, interviews on a variety of subjects, all relating to Black people here and around the world, but always from a left perspective, not a Democratic Party perspective. We're so confused about what the word left means in this country. But we are all leftists, and we think it's very important to, first of all, to remind people that this point of view exists. Well, to tell some people, to let some know that it exists, and to remind others that it didn't die off. And we think that it's Black people and our politics, or the politics we should have, are very central to what should be happening in this country. So BlackAgendaReport.com publishes every Wednesday, and I'm sure your listeners will enjoy reading.
And also, I really hope listeners will check out the Black Agenda Report podcast. And I want to note, I was telling you off air, you know, the great thing about Black Agenda Report is that you're willing to criticize some sacred cows at times. I know Bruce Dixon, the late Bruce Dixon, was willing to criticize Tim Wise, the anti-racist activist, on some things. And I think it's good that we have a website that's willing to question people that usually don't get questioned. I think we need that. I think we need that type of principle.
Yeah, well, there's so many people who are prominent not because they really have anything to offer. They're prominent because they are Tim Wise, in my opinion, is just a grifter. I mean, he gets credit for saying things about racism that are pretty obvious, things that a Black person could not make the money he makes saying the same thing. But he showed his colors, his true colors, when he suddenly declared he was in favor of charter schools. And that is not something that anybody on the left ought to be doing. And if you read him on Twitter, you can see that he's basically a neoliberal Democrat. And you know, people like that, it has to be pointed out, because unless you follow the news very, very closely, unless you're, you know, like me, a news junkie and know who to follow on social media, you don't know what it is you should be paying attention to. And that's where Black Agenda Report comes in. So if there's a Black president, we will question, is it such a great thing to have a Black president? Because he got to be president the same way, making promises to wealthy people and corporate interests. So that's the kind of thing that we analyze. And I think we do, if I may say so myself, I think we do a pretty good job.
Well, one more question before presidential. I thought I could ask it is, you mentioned that Black Agenda Report is a leftist sort of perspective, a leftist Black perspective. What sort of led you to the left? Because I think a lot of people, as you said, they confuse left and Democrat a lot.
Yeah, you know, as the country has moved further and further to the right, the meaning of left has gotten very confused. And we're talking about socialism, frankly. And we assert that fact, and we don't hide it. So myself and Glenn and our other colleagues, Nellie Bailey, Danny Haifong, Ajamu Baraka, and Garrison, we are for a just country, and we all say that you cannot have justice and equality and have capitalism. You can't have peace around the world with capitalism. It creates predation and wars. So I came to the left actually as a result of starting to write a Black Agenda report, and I thought of myself as a leftist and then realized I wasn't that much. But it's good to meet new people. It's good to hear other points of view, because then you can see how you've been misinformed. And that was one of the reasons I wrote the book. We, despite being educated, going to school, going to college, we are really terribly misinformed in this country. We're indoctrinated. We're propagandized. And one of the ways we're propagandized is that the left-wing point of view is either omitted outright or constantly disparaged.
Well, I think that's a good segue into Prejudential. This is a book that really questions a lot of sacred cows we have about our presidents over the years. And not just the Republican presidents. I mean, you go all the way back to the Founding Fathers and pointing out that, you know, the myths we cherish about the Founding Fathers are just that. They are, in a great many ways, myths.
Sure. It's yes, I have the book is 45 chapters. I have an essay on each president. I say more and about some than others. But in order to deconstruct this country and deconstruct its history, you have to talk about the political leadership who are held up, who are exalted. We have a holiday dedicated to them, you know, President's Day, Lincoln's birthday, cities and high schools named after me. I mean, how many Jefferson and Washington schools are there? It's I was in Philadelphia and I realized there's a Thomas Jefferson University, and I'm someplace else. There's a James Madison University. Their faces are on the money. And this pantheon of people are held up in order to defend the system. So and you can't do that if you tell the truth about them. So, for example, of the first 12 presidents, 10 of them were slaveholders. The only two who were not of that first group were the Adamses, father and son, but they were problematic as well. And it's my hope that people who are interested in history, and I think it's important, you know, at a certain, if once you make that move to the left, you realize how misinformed you have been. And I'm still learning new things. There are people who've done great things in history, and I'd never heard of them until someone on social media tells me about Claudia Jones, who was born in Trinidad. She was deported from the United States to the UK because she was a communist. And she's now buried next to Karl Marx. She was a great thinker and writer, but I had never heard of her until I started moving in these circles. There's so many people who ought to be admired instead of these men who did so many terrible things. And Americans don't like to think of their country in a negative light. But it was founded as a settler colonial state, and that means it began with the genocide against the indigenous people. The second genocide was chattel slavery, and you can't have that as part of your history and expect to have a just and equal and not non-racist society. And that is why we need to know that Washington was a slaveholder, to know that the city of Washington, D.C., our nation's capital. Why did they build a new city? I mean, and it's the sort of thing nobody ever told me. It was just, well, they, you know, built a new city on the Potomac River, but why would you build a new capital? There were already cities, but it was a compromise, constant compromises to the South, where slavery was more important to the economy, and I put it that way because there was also slavery in the North at that time. So they build a new city on a swamp to make sure between Maryland and Virginia, to make sure that it was safely located within the slaveocracy, and that in so doing, it was protected from anyone who had abolitionist notions. And we can see why they had to do that. George Washington, so the first capital was New York City. That's where Washington was inaugurated. Then it moved further south to Philadelphia. And Pennsylvania had a law that any enslaved person who was in the state for 6 months would be free. And that was a problem for Washington, who he and his wife owned several hundred people. So he had to rotate his enslaved people, make sure that none of them stayed in Philadelphia for 6 months, and sent them back to Mount Vernon and sent somebody else up. And that's the kind of thing that he was facing, he and others. And that's why they had to build a new city. But why is that something we're never taught? We do know why. But that's an example of the things that I write about in the book.
It's interesting you mentioned Washington. I did not know the anecdote about his teeth, the wooden teeth. And I guess some of the things he did with the human beings he owned as slaves involving their teeth is I was like shocked.
Yeah, we were told he had wooden teeth and he had dentures. But he also, at the time, there was tooth transplantation where you extracted a tooth from someone, one person, and gave it to another. And 9 of his teeth came from people he owned. And that has to be, just going to the dentist, even now with modern medicine and, having a tooth extracted is brutal. Then in the 1700s, he did it. He could do it. He owned them. And he could do whatever he wanted. And he could chase down one young woman managed to escape. He spent time and money trying to get her back. One young lady. That is an example of the really horrible things that these people did. That the rest of us should know.
I agree 110%. Even if there's things that people may respect about our presidents or positive aspects that we can look towards, to not criticize our presidents at all and to treat them as we do the founding fathers as almost religious figures, I think it does a disservice to everyone who wants to create a better world, not just for ourselves, but for our children, our grandchildren, etc.
Yeah, it does. And it's a funny thing. You said it's almost religious. I think that's what you said. And Glenn Ford says that America's religion is white supremacy. And I agree with him that it's true that these people are venerated and worshipped even. It's not hard to understand why. If you want to venerate the country, you have to venerate the leadership. And if you don't elevate them to this stature, then you inevitably you're going to question the country. And most people aren't comfortable doing that, but I think they would be if they had some guidance. Have these biographers, these historians who basically lie. And I say now that omissions are also lies. If you omit what we just talked about with George Washington, if you don't mention the fact that so many presidents were slaveholders and the ones who weren't did everything in their power to protect that system, when you omit those things, when you call Lincoln the emancipator, the liberator, and you don't say that he never gave up hope that Black people could be taken out of the country. And that there was briefly a colony off the coast of Haiti. So when you omit that, you're telling a lie. And you can say that he was, that Jefferson was erudite and he spoke French and Lincoln was self-educated and he wrote great words. Okay, that's true. But so are the other things that I'm talking about. Those are true as well. And we have to stop treating people like they're stupid, like they're, hothouse flowers that are going to wilt and die when they hear these things. Now, people do that because things are covered up so much. When the year Trump first came to office in 2017, there was a lot of discussion about monuments to Confederate figures and the the riot in, I'll call it a riot in Charlottesville, where one person was killed. And Trump said, he says, well, you know, what are you going to do? Jefferson and Washington owned slaves. Are you going to take down their monuments? And the New York Times did a poll, took a poll of their readers, most of whom were not Trump supporters. And only 4% of them said that monuments to Jefferson and Washington ought to be removed. So that is where we are, where people are loath to let go of this belief system.
It's interesting you mentioned Jefferson. I know when I was in school, we were taught that Jefferson is complicated because he owned slaves. And I just think, why can't we just say what Jefferson was? I mean, ultimately, he was a hypocrite. I mean, yes. He may have said that he was he wanted to abolish slavery, but he knew he couldn't because that would affect his lifestyle, his sort of aristocratic lifestyle in some ways. And, you know, I just think it's unfair that we can't openly discuss these things within the so-called mainstream discourse.
Oh, yeah. And it's, you know, they're covering up for them. If you say, well, complicated is a way of saying that someone was wrong or some act was wrong, but you don't want to say it. So you say, well, it was complicated. Well, there's nothing complicated about owning people, about having sex with one of them when she was a teenage kid, about for years saying slavery was wrong and I don't know what we'll do. And it's like a wolf by the ears and you can't let it go. He was not going to give up this system that benefited him personally, and it wasn't just for his own sake. The Louisiana Purchase, which it's ironic, France sold its American territories because of the Haitian Revolution, and they lost this very profitable colony, and so they needed to sell their properties on this continent. At ironically, they sold it because of a slave revolt, but then more territory was opened up for the plantation economy here. But that was Jefferson's goal, to expand slavery. And he talked about yeoman farmers and all kinds of crap. But come on, you know, we know what happened, that they were able to add Louisiana and Arkansas and Missouri and ultimately Texas and other places. But so, yes, he was a hypocrite. So, again, there's this need to cover for them instead of just being truthful about what he did. And once you and I, you know, there was a time I was affected by that when you have this Eurocentric education and view of the world. It's hard to really be truthful about them, but I think it's needed. It's necessary. And but it's, you know, it's held up by design. It's intentional, because if people questioned one thing, it's like, you know, unraveling a fabric. If you start pulling on it, the whole thing falls apart. And in order to maintain support for this country, you do have to maintain lies, because if people start thinking independently, they'll begin to question many different things.
I want to go back to Lincoln, but first, I have to ask, do you think the myths that we internalize about not only the founding fathers, but many of our other presidents in our history, do you think that that is something that is internalized not just by white people, but also other groups within the country, the black communities themselves?
Sure. It's easy to be brainwashed. I mean, I think we can use that word. I think it's accurate. And also, you know, in order to climb the ladder, to get academic position, to be in the best schools, to be in the media, you have to parrot this point of view. And unless you're really principled and committed about telling the truth, it's easy to fall into that trap. And you have people like, I don't want to talk about them too much, but this group ADOS, American Descendants of Slaves, and they go on and on about the founders and what the founders said is bizarre. So yes, you can, and you know, it's hard to argue against them, because even people who you respect, I think about the, and it was a good series for the most part about this Ken Burns, the Civil War. And he and others say, well, you know, Lincoln, at first he wanted colonization, that is to say, sending black people out of the country. But then he stopped saying it. He never stopped saying it. It's just not true. So, yes, many people can be infected by this, because, you know, if you only hear one thing, first of all, if you never hear the other side of the story, it can be hard to accept when you do hear it. It can even sound kind of crazy. But, you know, if you're a system affirming person, especially. But I think it's important for all Americans, for black people, too, to again grasp what it is I'm talking about. And people call it revisionist history. I hate that word. There's nothing revisionist about it. It's just history. It's just what happened, and what happened to a particular group of people, and how that impacted the history of the country and the history of that group, and how it affects us today. It's all very, very important to know. And also you know, it's people who are ambitious in some way. It's hard for them to be truthful too, even black people, which I think is what you're referring to.
In regards to Lincoln, it's interesting because I live in Pennsylvania, so we're right near the Mason-Dixon line. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's odd because I always come across people that will think, if you're criticizing Lincoln on anything he did, that, oh, you must be one of those neo-Confederates. And there are some odd neo-Confederates in Pennsylvania for some reason. But I don't think that's the case. I don't think criticizing him immediately means, oh, you must be one of those crazy League of the South people.
Well, that's interesting. But that's what happens when, you know, the truth isn't told. And then the narrative can be that someone gets to own the narrative who shouldn't. And so criticizing Lincoln is not to be pro-Confederate. It's just to be truthful. But it's hard for people to grasp because they've never heard anything differently. So if he's the Emancipation Proclamation, he signed the proclamation to send that colony to Haiti the day before the Emancipation Proclamation. And he never stopped talking about it. But if this is the first time you've heard it, and I think in fairness, I think I try to give people, try to cut people some slack and realizing how, what I was like, you know, that I was one of the brainwashed types for much of my life. It's hard to explain to people when they've never heard something, but I say, keep it simple and start slowly. And, you know, just a simple, no, I'm not from the League of the South, but this is, you know, this is based on fact. And see where it goes from there.
Well, what do you think is maybe the simple way of explaining Lincoln in a critical manner, if we could just lay it out for my audience?
I would say, you know, it's funny, often when any of these issues are raised, someone will inevitably say, well, he was a man of his times, you can't expect anything better. But I think you can say Lincoln was a man of his time. He fought in the Sac and Fox Wars in Illinois to take Confederate land. He was born in Kentucky. His wife was from Kentucky. His in-laws all fought for the Confederacy. So he was not this abolitionist that we're told he was. I think just to stick with the facts and say, yeah, he was a man of his time. And at that time, Illinois was the frontier, you know, was the Northwest. Northwestern University, it's in the middle of the country now, but that was the frontier. And he was typical settler mentality. And while he said slavery was wrong, he said that many times, if slavery's not wrong, nothing is wrong. But he He also did not want to end it. Towards the end of the war, he wanted to compensate the slaveholders and give them 30 years to free the enslaved people. He was going to give them till 1900 to do it. But so he was a man of his time. I guess I think it's important just to say, yes, it's all true. Yes, he was self-educated. Yes, he was very smart. Yes, he wrote great. The Gettysburg Address is a great address. His second inaugural address, even though he was pushing black people out of the country, he said had very eloquent words in support of the U.S. colored troops, the black men who fought in the war. So all of those things are true, but I think people hold on to it because everybody wants to be positive about their society, and but I think the answer is to tell people about others they can be wholeheartedly positive about. You know, if you want to venerate a white man who lived at that time, I say you should pick John Brown. But yeah, I think that's why people hang on. They want to be able to say, well, there was this good thing about the country, and but there was a lot of evil going on, too, and a lot of people carrying out the evil or making compromises with it. And that explains a lot about where the country is now. Then you can understand more, and you can look for other people to admire and respect and suggest that they be. I don't care who's on the money. It's, you know, I think it's just as well that the crooked people are on the money, you know. But name a park or a school or a city after John Brown. There should be a John Brown University or Frederick Douglass University or something.
I guess the only thing I'll add to that is, I mean, for me, the bottom line is that Lincoln was someone who, you know, at one point he wanted to make our country a whites-only nation. He really didn't care that much about slavery. He was mostly concerned with keeping the Union together. I think slavery became an issue because of that. But what's really insulting to me about the sort of great emancipator elevation of Lincoln is that, you know, it was people like John Brown, it was slaves and former slaves, it was radical abolitionists that pushed Lincoln. It was the people from the bottom taking, you know, the issue to the top that I think deserve the credit.
Yes, and it's always the people who make changes. When, you know, when presidents do the right thing, it's almost always because they're forced to by the popular will. So when the war began and Lincoln was, you know, saying, please, pretty please come back into the Union and I'll compensate you for your slaves. But when the enslaved kept running away to Union lines, they forced the issue. They made it a war against slavery. Lyndon Johnson, yes, he shepherded through the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, but that's because of a mass movement that forced his hand. So
wasn't LBJ, I mean, he was pretty openly racist in his
Very much so. He was a Texas cracker, if I may be so bold as to use the word. And at that time, it's important to point out the Democrats were the party of the segregated South. And you balance the ticket. Kennedy's from the North, so he needs a Southerner, and he picks this powerful Texas senator to be his running mate. But yes, he was. But the people forced his hand and created a political crisis, and that is a good thing. That's something we want. We want more crises, because then that's where you get you really get change. When there is a determination to assert rights and to assert that that people should not be treated in the way they always have been, and that it should no longer be acceptable, and when people go all out and risk everything, that, and they pushed the system, and they pushed the recalcitrant politicians, and they pushed the moderates to take a stand and stop sitting on the fence. That is where we get change. So it's the people who deserve the credit for good things happening.
Now, I believe I heard that one of the catalysts for this project, Prejudential, was wanting to examine Theodore Roosevelt. And I found the Roosevelt chapter very interesting, especially when it came to Roosevelt and Booker T. Washington. Maybe for my listeners that are unfamiliar with that history, maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about Booker T. Washington and what happens between him and Roosevelt.
Sure. Theodore Roosevelt became president when McKinley was assassinated. He was one of these old money, I don't know why we use the word aristocratic in a country that's not supposed to have an aristocracy, but that's how he is described. And he said that black people were inferior to white people and a perfectly stupid race, among other things. But like most white people, he admired Booker T. Washington, and Washington was known for being an accommodationist, and he was the king of patronage for black people, and he counseled black people not to demand civil rights, but in exchange for not demanding political power to get jobs and so forth, generally something through him. So Roosevelt decides to invite Washington to dinner at the White House, and he didn't think anything of it. But then there was this firestorm of controversy about a black person being invited to the White House. And then Roosevelt and his people backtracked, and they said, well, it wasn't really dinner. It was just lunch. And then people asked, was Washington allowed to sit with the white ladies? And it was like, no, he didn't meet Mrs. Roosevelt. And Washington himself was criticized after telling other black people that they should not want integration. He accepted the invitation to dine at the White House. But then as a result of all the protests, very racist protests against him for inviting Booker T. Washington, he said that the residence was not called the White House officially. It was called the Executive Mansion. It was called the President's Home. It was called various things. And then he declared is now henceforth going to be called the White House. And Theodore Roosevelt talked about his white Navy going around the world. So it was an interesting moment for both men who did not realize the times they were living in. And Roosevelt did something, one of the worst things he did. There was a regiment of black soldiers stationed in Texas, and they were under attack from the moment they arrived. They were blamed for killing a white person. And at that time, black people were Republicans. It was the party of Lincoln, after all. The Democrats were the party of the segregated South. So those black people who lived in the North who could vote voted for Republicans. So Theodore Roosevelt waited till after Election Day in 1906 to court-martial the soldiers, to kick them out of the army, to deprive them of benefits, to keep them from ever being in the military again. And it was pretty shameful that he did that knowingly. And there was one Republican named Foraker from Ohio who, to his credit, spoke up about this this terrible injustice. But after the Booker T. Washington incident, Roosevelt went straight to the bottom of the barrel of racism. He said that lynchings were caused by black men raping white women. It was pretty bad. And yes, that is how the project began. I wrote about Roosevelt and a friend and supporter of Black Agenda Report suggested I write about all the presidents, and I said yes.
Maybe briefly you could give your thoughts on the other Roosevelt, FDR, because he's sort of treated as, you know, the pinnacle almost of presidents in the 20th century. It's almost become impossible to criticize him in a lot of ways.
Well, yeah, he did. He was a monumental figure. He changed the presidency. He changed the government. The fact that for someone to assert that the government had a role to play in the lives of people and establishing Social Security and other programs that still exist to this day is important. And Black people loved him and his wife and Eleanor Roosevelt. My people of my parents' generation loved them. But he also, there were for decades people, Black people demanded some protection, legislation against lynching. And Franklin Roosevelt would always say, well, my hands are tied. I need the support of Democrats in the South. He did sign some tepid civil rights legislation dealing with employment in the defense industries, but that's because A. Philip Randolph threatened a march on Washington. And Eleanor Roosevelt, it's understandable at that time when Black people were rendered invisible for her to, befriend Mary McLeod Bethune and to have helped Marian Anderson give that performance at Lincoln Memorial on Easter Sunday. Those were important things to Black people at that time. But she was like her husband. She wrote a column she had a column, and she wrote one called If I Were a Negro. And she said, if I were a Negro, I might be angry, but I'd be very happy to be in this country instead of Africa. And I wouldn't ask for too much, and I wouldn't push too hard. And so that is what Eleanor Roosevelt also did. So and even with his New Deal legislation, the Social Security Act excluded domestic work and farm work, and what did Black people do? Most Black people lived in the South, actually still live in, most Black people still are in the South, and did agricultural work and domestic work. So it had to be amended later in the, I believe it wasn't until the 50s. So that is what you got with Roosevelt, a man who did do many good things, but Black people could not depend upon him.
It's interesting you mention Republicans and Democrats, because I still see a lot of right-wing sort of propaganda outlets that will say, it is the Republicans who are actually the party for Black people and the Black communities in America. And I know you're not a Democrat, but there just seems to be this weird propaganda campaign for the Republicans to say, we're not the racist party. But things sort of have changed in the middle half of the 20th century, I would say.
Yeah, well, it's like a polar shift in the late 60s when the Democrats became the party that became identified with the civil rights movement, the human rights movement. The Republicans immediately saw an opening, and they became the party, the white people's party. And that is how the duopoly works. Sort of necessity, considering this country's history, one party is going to represent the interests and will be identified, will be represented as the white people's party. And that shifted in the late 60s. And when Nixon won in 1968, it was a reaction to the civil rights movement. And, they used to be called the Yellow Dog Democrats, meaning that white Southerners, they'd vote for a yellow dog before they'd vote for a Republican. Well, that all changed over time. And now the Democrat in the South means Black. And most white people vote for Republicans, and not just Trump. Every Republican gets more votes from white people, give more of their votes to Republicans than they do to Democrats. So that's an important thing. So, but these Republicans, they shouldn't be given too much credit. All you have to do is point out the history. It's like that's, really, you were to act as though they were. It's been a long time since they were identified as the party that represented Black interests. And in fact, their success in recent decades has all that I also talk about in the book, people like Nixon and Reagan. Reagan made some very racist appeals, talking about welfare queens and states' rights, giving us making comments about states' rights while he was in Mississippi, of all places. So there was a Californian talking about states' rights, which is a code word for segregation. So Trump differs only in that he dispensed with the code words and got straight to the heart of the matter for most white people.
Well, it's interesting, too, because a lot of these figures within the right are very proud of all of this. You mentioned in the book Spiro Agnew, Nixon's Nixon, yes, the vice president to Richard Nixon. He was saying, you know, yeah, I am guilty of trying to create and amplify divisions, and I'm pretty proud of it.
Oh, very much so. He was the attack dog, and he played that role very well. He was also crooked and ended up having to resign because when he was governor of Maryland, he was involved in some really stupid corruption. But yes, he was the person who got to make the racist remark. And that's why, you know, they balanced the ticket with someone from a border state. But that was also his reputation. So that is how Nixon solidified his base of support, by being that the person who was going to stop the movement of the 60s and the early 70s, and they did stop it.
Under the code word of law and order.
Law and order, that's what he said. Yes, there was always a code word. Law and order, forced busing, small government. All of these things are, you know, they're all dog whistles that are meant to signal to white people that the person making the statements is going to help them keep their privilege and make sure that there's no movement to bring any equality to anybody else.
I just want to put a fine point on this sort of seismic shift that happens between Republicans and Democrats, because I think younger people may not always consider it. And what's really interesting, when you really dig down and think about it, when Nixon comes into office, you know, from that point on, we basically have Republican dominance of the White House for a really long time. There's the 4-year period with Carter, but outside of that, it's total domination of these pretty much openly racist Republicans, from Nixon to Reagan to George H.W. Bush, until we get Clinton.
Yes, and Clinton was, despite being a Democrat, he was also very conservative. And it's, I can't remember, was it a new Democrat being from, I mean, at that time, there were a few Democrats left in the South, but they were more conservative. That's how they got elected. And during his first campaign in 1992, he left the campaign trail to execute a mentally disabled black man back in Arkansas. There was a sister soldier moment meant to embarrass Jesse Jackson and to make it clear to white people that he was going to keep somebody like Jesse Jackson in his place. And
what was the sister soldier moment for people that may be unfamiliar?
Oh, sure, sure. At that time, it was shortly after, and if I talk about Rodney King, I guess I have to explain who he was to. Rodney King, the Rodney King case, the late Rodney King now, was a black man in Los Angeles, and someone videoed him being beaten by the police. The police were acquitted. There was a riot. People were very tragic. People were killed. And Sister Soulja, who was a rapper, she made this remark. What was it she said? I mean, she was making a good point. She said, well, why is it terrible for black people to kill white people when it's okay for white people to kill black people, or something? Well, I hope I'm not mangling it too badly. And he made these remarks in front of, it was at an event with Jesse Jackson. She said, I'm sorry, I got it wrong. If black people kill black people every day, why not have a weekend kill white people? And she was making a larger point about how crime is perceived and who is a worthy victim and who is not. But Clinton quoted her and he said, He compared her to Klansman David Duke. It was terrible. But black people, including me, voted for him anyway because he was the Democrat. He had this horrible photo op in Georgia, outside a jail, the Stone Mountain Correctional Facility. And these prisoners, almost all of them black men, were lined up. And he gave this speech about being tough on crime. So yes, he broke the Republican winning streak. But he did so by sticking with some of the same tropes.
I also think about mass incarceration under Clinton. I think about Hillary Clinton's super predators comment, which it's interesting. I remember when Clinton was running in 2016, there were people saying, oh, what she said wasn't racist. She was talking about gangs. And I said, no, it's code word. That's just what it is. And, you know, it's really sad that the entire Democratic Party basically moved right wing since Nixon, because they're like, well, we can't win elections now.
Yes, absolutely. And they could have won elections. They just, you know, didn't want to. But speaking of Hillary Clinton, let's not forget she was raised a Republican. She talked about being a Goldwater girl. Let's not forget that. But yes, she and her husband did these things, but they were allowed to get away with it. And, you know, the crack cocaine so-called epidemic, where a drug that was used and sold only by black people was suddenly deemed to be worse than the form of the same drug by white people. And thousands of people were locked up for decades at a time. But that is what happened when the movement ended. And the only option presented to us was electoral politics. And that meant sticking with Democrats no matter who they were, no matter how horrible they were. And that was definitely epitomized in Barack Obama. Not only was a Democrat, but he was the first black president. So he could make what I would say are racist remarks about black men, the constant scolding about black men being irresponsible, and jokes about Cousin Pookie and bailing out the banks that impoverished black people and created the financial crisis, and killing Gaddafi in North Africa. All of these things he was defended too. And it's even worse now. It's quite sad, really, that Democrats look at Joe Biden now. I mean, I guess I have to keep adding chapters, huh? The Democratic Party establishment is trying to get Joe Biden the nomination, and he was against busing. And he has made some very racist remarks over the years, but he's the Democrat. And especially now that the Republican is Trump, of all people, we're not supposed to question anything when these people try to ram him down our throats and try to get us to believe he's the one who can beat Trump, which I believe is not the case at all anyway. But that move to the right and the Democrats being a party of corporate interests, just like the Republicans, is alive and well.
Real quickly, since you mentioned Barack Obama, I know a lot of people hail him as the first black president. I mean, there were people hailing Clinton as the first black president at one point.
Yes.
But then years later, we actually got
a real
black
one, yes.
President. But, you know, there's things about Obama I just can't abide by. I can't abide by him going to a black church and bringing up stereotypes about black fathers abandoning their children. And I also can't abide by his distancing himself from Reverend Jeremiah Wright, because everyone focuses on that one clip of Jeremiah Wright saying, "God damn America," but they don't listen to the entire speech where he's saying we can't be reactionary and keep bombing people. He mentions in that speech all the things that America has gotten wrong. And he's speaking from the heart, saying no wonder people are angry with us as a country. And what did Obama do? He distanced himself from Jeremiah Wright. And I always found that like very just off-putting.
Well, yeah, it was. Well, let's be honest about why he joined Wright's church. Once he decided to go into politics, he did all the right things. And he knew that in order to get black people to vote for him, there were certain things he had to do. He had to, you know, stop dating white women and, you know, marry a black woman. And he had to join the right church and no pun intended, the right church in this case, joining Rights Church in the United Church of Christ was a great political move. But that's all it was to him. And when he ran for president and anyone and everyone was being used against him, he just tossed them under the bus. It was very insulting. And you're absolutely right. He said, you know, Wright was behind the times and he was like your old uncle. And, you know, he didn't say crazy uncle, but we all got the subtext. And but the idea of him being president was so huge. And this desire to see the black face in a high place is so powerful that people overlooked all kinds of things he did. Well, and I noticed that it was funny. Colin Powell being a Secretary of State was like the dry run because he helped invade Iraq, the sort of thing black people are opposed to. By every measure, always we're a lot less likely to be in favor of those aggressions. But people, I saw it then. It's like, well, that's what he has to do, and we should be glad he has that job. And so when Obama was president, it was even worse. The pressure to overlook and to excuse was quite intense.
And I have to say, on some level, I can have a little bit of empathy for Obama, just because you mentioned the, you know, having to stop dating white girls thing. I think there are probably white voters that would have thought, how dare he do that?
Oh, sure. He made political, when he decided to go into politics, he made these life choices. And I can understand why. But as far as the broader political context, in order to be president of this country, there's certain things that you won't be allowed to do.
You can't make white people angry. You can't make men angry. You have to make these white people feel comfortable.
And yes, you do.
It's a messed up thing in this country.
Quite messed up in the sense of aggrievement. And I'm guessing you've seen these polls that show white people feel like they're the most mistreated people in the country. So, yes, if that's what you want, if you want to get white people to vote for you and you can't be president unless you get some of them, that is what you have to do. So to me, it's a devil's bargain. And that goes back to my original point. What does it mean to be president of the United States? What do the presidents do? What have they done throughout history? This country has quite a terrible history with racism and imperialism. And so that person, that president, is the representative of that system and gets the position because he pledges not to change it very much. So I am this devil's bargain to me is not at all attractive. But also because so much of the opposition to Obama was racist, that also helped, because I would see people who were ready or seemed to be ready to have some sort of critique or to question him. And no sooner than they would, than some, you know, cracker congressman would yell out, you know, call him a liar during the State of the Union address. That's something I don't care to live through again.
I know we're running up against the hour mark here. There were just two more things I wanted to ask you very, very briefly, if I could.
Sure.
The first is, we're often told that Donald Trump, this president that we have sitting in the White House right now, is an anomaly. And I just want you to comment on that, because I know both of us give a side eye at that statement.
Well, he's not. It's an amazing story. The fact that this man is president, he's the first president in the modern era who never held elective office, who marketed himself as a successful businessman, which he isn't, by the way, that he was known for being on reality television, and he ends up becoming the president. It's an amazing story. But he is not an anomaly. We've had presidents who made the blatant racist appeal. That's not new. What's new is his lack of grace and his lack of interest in following the niceties. So he's like the id of white America. And that is his one political skill. He knows his people. And he knew them well enough to get elected. But there are a lot of things wrong with this country before January 20th, 2017, the day he was inaugurated. We still had more people incarcerated than any other country in the world. Half of all people in prison are black. A quarter of the people in prison on the planet are black Americans. We have huge inequality. We have the little bit of safety net we had has been deliberately destroyed. People are forced into this race to the bottom where they can only depend on low wage work, not even real jobs, the so-called gig economy. And this is why they don't want Bernie Sanders. They will not allow any talk of change. They don't want people to have any inkling that they might have something better, that we might have the benefits that people in the rest of the world can expect to have. And that was true before Trump. Unfortunately, his rise to power, and he's such a, the thing about Trump, he's such an awful person. It's, his policies aren't that much different from other presidents, but he's such a dreadful individual, I think. And I think that really triggers people. And so it's anybody but Trump. We've got to get rid of Trump. And that is used as a cover for a lot of scoundrels to cover their tracks and to push Joe Biden on us, who I believe would lose to Trump, just for what it's worth.
I was going to mention really quickly, you know, Jeffrey St. Clair from Counterpunch recently said something that I found, you know, pretty scary. He said, Bidenism is probably going to be even more to the right than Clintonism was.
Oh, sure. It's a funny thing. Every president moves the needle further to the right. So that during one of the recent debates, they were asked, would you Trump move the U.S. embassy from Jerusalem? And none of them said that they would move it back to Tel Aviv. None of them. Not even Bernie Sanders, who says nice things about the Palestinians sometimes. Will they undo what Trump did? Will they undo the tax cuts? No. Obama made Bush's tax cuts for the rich people. He made them permanent. So that's the kind of thing that we can expect to see with a Democrat. But because it's not Trump, I think, and people, you know, black people, but I think everybody in the country now, the expectation has gone lower and lower and lower, and so now we're supposed to be happy with somebody who's not an overt racist, and that's very sad.
It's interesting you mentioned Bernie. That was the last question I was going to ask. I wanted to ask for your thoughts on the Sanders campaign and whether it failed to reach out for the black community.
I don't know that he failed to. It's interesting. There's this an intangible thing that, aren't feeling Bernie Sanders. But there's also been a concerted effort to lie about him. For example, he gave a speech in Mississippi a couple of years ago, and people claimed he disrespected Obama. He referred to him as a candidate, and he didn't refer to him as president, which was a lie. He referred to him as a candidate when he was talking about the 2008 campaign, but he also referred to him as president. It's that kind of thing. So when he says accurately, the establishment, Democratic Party establishment, doesn't want him to be president, people start saying he's calling black voters the establishment. So there's a couple of things going on. He has made some mistakes, but there's also, and I'm just going to call it propaganda against him, because the things he's talking about are things black people need and want, and they have to smear him and lie about him to keep him from getting that support.
And I would just add this. I think, you know, after South Carolina, the way I've seen a lot of the establishment Democrats talk about black voters, to me, I think it's actually demeaning towards black communities, because I don't like treating the black community as just a single monolith that all thinks the same. I think there's something to me that's just unseemly about that. I think the black community is actually very, there's a lot of differences of thought. It's not just a monolith.
Yeah, and I think so. On some issues it is. I mean, 90% of us vote for the same party, so in a way it is, but you're correct. Democrats take advantage, and they know we're not going to vote for a Republican. So, for example, one of the reasons Trump won was voter suppression. And black votes being lost every election, black votes are stolen, and the Democrats never say anything about it. So I would have a little bit of respect for them if they actually wanted to protect our franchise, but they don't. They don't do anything about it. So that is disrespectful to us. And that is, they need our, I like to say they need our votes, but they wish they didn't. And their goal is always to turn to more of the white party. That is always what they want. They go on and on about getting the silent majority or the Tea Party or Trump's base or whatever name is being used. They wish they did not have to depend on black votes, and that's how they act.
Well, Margaret Kimberly, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. I think people should really check out your new book, Prejudential. I always like to end on a positive note. It seems that we're living in very, very dark times now, though, with coronavirus and a possibility of a Biden versus Trump election, in which I just don't know what to do with that. But anything you can say about maybe how we, the left, can move forward in the future in a positive way?
We have to assert our rights on the left, and we can start now with this campaign. People should not give up. We're already being told by these scoundrels the primary should end. We don't need any more debates. That's all to make. But that tells you the power and the fear they have of the people asserting themselves. So Frederick Douglass famously said, agitate, agitate, agitate. And I think that those words still apply. And if you are on the left, and, you know, Sanders is a, you know, the most left-leaning Democrat, I would say, don't worry about whether he endorses Biden or whether he campaigns for him. What are you going to do? Are you going to stand up? Are you going to stay in the Democratic Party? So that is, those are my words, and those are positive words, because the fact that they have spent all this time and energy and money to make you think that you don't, you shouldn't have what you want, or that other people don't want what they really want, is an indicator of the power that people still have. So I think that's a positive. I hope that's a positive thing to say.
I just wanted to add something to that really briefly. You know, I see a lot of people that don't like Bernie within the Democrats saying, why doesn't he just drop out already? And they'll say, oh, he's working for Russia. That's a whole nother story. And then they'll say, you know, oh, he's trying to hurt the party. Why doesn't he just drop out? And I've said to these people, you know why he's not dropping out? Because he wants to debate Biden on Medicare for All, because he believes that we all deserve Medicare for
and
all. That's
and
why
also,
he's doing
it's a lie that it's over. Biden does not have an insurmountable lead. He's behind, but it can be done. So they are lying. So people should just not believe that. So that is maybe that's my final word. But there's got to be accountability. And when he says something like he thinks Biden could have beaten Trump, he should never have said that. You have to be able to say, no, Bernie, you're wrong, and you're slitting your own throat when you do things like that. People can't see themselves through him or through anybody. And that's a common problem in American politics, where we hope that an individual is going to be our savior. So agitate and depend on yourselves. Those are my words.
Thank you again, Margaret Kimberly, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you very much.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Margaret Kimberly of Black Agenda Report and author of the new book, Prejudential, Black America and the Presidents, available now from Penguin Random House. Give it a read, folks. Let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@protonmail.com. Also, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon. Have a lot of new content that I need to get released on Patreon, including archived editions of the main show and a new edition of Parallax Views, The Week That Was. So if you can support me, I realize these are very trying times for all of us, but your continued support and listenership is very much appreciated. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.